And the results were negative, but this was attributed to the fact that there were several sites in Russia and Georgia, the country, not the state, that ended up enrolling patients that it turns out likely weren't eligible.
If you're listening, Italy, it wasn't your fault this time.
Oh, you're saving it up.
Welcome to Freely Filtered, the irregularly irregular podcast that summarizes and discusses recent NEFJC journal clubs. NEFJC is an online site for post-publication peer review that provides summaries, visual abstracts, interactive chats, newsletters, and podcasts on the research and developments that are driving nephrology forward. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only and is not intended to give medical advice. If you have questions about your health, you should talk with your doctor. This podcast discusses off-label and unapproved medications, but not tonight. Tonight, we're going to be talking about finerenone and its use in heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. This is actually, we're a little off-road when we're talking about the study Fine Arts. And if you're flipping back through the NEFJC back catalog looking for when NEFJC discussed Fine Arts, you will not find it. What do we did discuss, what did we find, what was it, what was that?
Fine Hearts.
Fine Hearts, which was a meta-analysis of Fine Arts, Fidelio, and Figaro, right? Mm-hmm. And then looked at a bunch of outcomes, and it was generally, though not completely positive. It wasn't positive for cardiovascular death, I believe, but it was positive for overall mortality. And I think it was also positive for renal outcomes, if I remember that correctly. That's one we did cover in FJC, but we actually decided that we were going to talk about Fine Arts. I don't remember why we decided to do that. Why are we doing Fine Arts and not Fine Hearts? What was the reasoning behind that?
I think Fine Hearts was ridiculous. Like, we haven't done the intros, though. We didn't introduce all of us.
And Jordy yelled at me for picking this during the draft, and she wanted to come back for round two.
Oh, you soundly. Yeah, that was actually wonderful. Let's do the introductions, as Swap says. Swap's frozen, so we'll start with him. Swap?
Hey, I'm Swap Nilhirmat. I'm a nephrologist at the University of Ottawa. Don't have any disclosures apart from being a Spiro stan. And I think finerenone is just a homeopathic version of spironolactone.
It's the version of spironolactone with evidence, is what you meant to say.
No, it's the hydrochlorothiazide 12.5 milligrams of spironolactone.
Okay, AC?
Hey, I'm AC Gomez. I am a MedPeds nephrology fellow, and I never have any conflicts of interest.
Excellent. Nayan?
My name is Nayan Arora. I'm a nephrologist at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon. I am at Captain Chloride. I drank the blue Kool-Aid last week, so now I'm pretty much only on Blue Sky. I do have a disclosure that I used to do consulting work for Bayer.
Jordy?
I'm Jordy Cohen. I'm a nephrologist and epidemiologist at the University of Pennsylvania. My only disclosure is that I'm a little bit obsessed with the HFpEF literature, and I'm currently leading an NIH-sponsored trial of management of hypertension in HFpEF, so I'm going to have strong opinions tonight.
Excellent. And we have a special guest, Brendan.
Hey, everyone. My name is Brendan Ewan. I'm a nephrologist at Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney, Australia, and a senior fellow at the George Institute for Global Health. In terms of disclosures, I serve on the steering committee of the FIND-CKD trial, which is evaluating finerenone in non-diabetic kidney disease. And I work quite closely with the investigators who conducted the Fine Arts trial, but not specifically on this trial itself.
Are you still considered a special guest if you've done 10 of these episodes at this
point? I know, right? I was thinking the same thing. He does. He feels you're like the least special of all the guests.
I feel like we need jackets like they have for SNL for like the Five Timers Club or things like that. Like, we need like a Five Timers Club.
We're going to do that.
Or can we just call him one of us?
One of us. One of us. Yeah.
You definitely get less swag that way.
you get editing rights.
Yeah. One more episode and you get to edit it. So let's go back. So we talked in FJC about Fine Hearts, which is the meta-analysis. Why did we decide to do the meta-analysis rather than Fine Arts?
So the Fine Arts kidney outcomes hadn't come out. And at the time we decided to do it, right, we didn't know that the Fine Arts kidney would be coming out.
And those came out at Kidney Week, and that was Nain's pick for the live draft.
Exactly. And fine arts itself did not seem exciting enough, right? It was heart failure. We had already discussed Fidelio, right? Why would a nephrology journal club discuss a heart failure trial? Though we have done that in the past. So that's why we thought, okay, let's pick fine arts because it has the other, you know, diabetic kidney disease trials also. I'm not sure that was the right decision.
We're writing that wrong as we speak, I guess. This drug, finerenone, seems to draw out very strong opinions among nephrologists. Jordi, why don't you discuss your priors before we go any further?
Yes, my priors that will be very hard to disprove are essentially that those of us who are aware of the older literature have been using spironolactone and eplerenone as a second agent after ACE inhibitors or ARBs for proteinuria reduction for ages clinically, because we've known that it assists with reducing proteinuria and that it's also an excellent antihypertensive medication that most of our patients really benefit from since we have such a high prevalence of resistant hypertension in our population. The introduction of finerenone was fascinating to us because all of us were thinking, well, great, it's another version of a mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist, but maybe less side effects because it's non-steroidal. And what it's turned out to be is not an antihypertensive medication, but yes, fantastic in terms of proteinuria outcomes. But there's this entire sort of school working to try to vilify spironolactone and eplerenone and make it seem as though they have no benefit, and that all of the benefit is due to this non-steroidal magic, and that really only finerenone should be used, whereas we're sitting here thinking to ourselves, but what about all of our resistant hypertensive patients with chronic kidney disease, which make up the majority of our patient population? So I am still using lots and lots of spironolactone and eplerenone in my patients when needed, potentially with K-binders, more often with loop diuretics and thiazide-like diuretics to help with calureuresis. And I really need to be convinced that I should be using more finerenone, except in those few patients I have that are like very borderline hypotensive or hypotensive who also happen to have proteinuria.
So from the pathophysiology perspective, you know, pharmacology rather, I think the binding that it has with the mineralocorticoid receptor is also pretty strong. Like it doesn't do much to the androgen receptors and progesterone receptors, which is nice. But I think its specificity for the mineralocorticoid receptor is pretty strong. But the androgenic side effects and stuff at the doses we use, right? This is probably equivalent to maybe 12.5, maybe lower of spironolactone. We don't see the androgenic side effects anyways at those doses, right? The gynecomastia happens at 25, 50, 100, that are kind of doses we use in PA, right? Not at the teeny weeny doses that this represents. So I'm not sure of that attraction itself. And the hyperkalemia advantage is like, who cares, right? I don't think it's really, we haven't done a proper head-to-head at the doses of spironolactone that this represents. Maybe it's a little bit lower, but it's not like it's zero versus, you know, 50% hyperkalemia. It's maybe, you know, a little bit of hyperkalemia and a little bit more perhaps with spironolactone at the best of times. So I'm really, again, there have been no head-to-head trials. I'm sure Nayan is just chomping at the bits to contradict us about his finerenone push. But the lack of head-to-head trial makes it really hard for us to say, you know, one is better than the other. Though my belief is like yours, Jordi.
Because Nayan's going to say, I can just predict this, you guys keep wishing for your perfect trial, but it came and it didn't prove anything. And there has not been a good trial and there will not be a good trial for spironolactone versus placebo in the elegant and beautiful way that the trial we're about to discuss was conducted.
I'm not even arguing that spironolactone probably works just as well. What I'm saying is finerenone, if nothing else, renewed the debate and renewed the interest in spironolactone. Because yes, if I go to Jordi's clinic and I have proteinuric CKD, she's going to give me spironolactone whether I have maybe hypertension or not. What I'm saying is in the vast majority of clinics out there, if you have residual albuminuria after, let's say, ACE or ARB and SGLT2 inhibitors with diabetic kidney disease, I don't know how many people are treating those patients with mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists. And similarly with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, which we're going to talk about, in our clinic, in our cardiorenal clinic, everybody with HFpEF gets an MRA and it's spironolactone right now. And we may have to discuss changing that based on this trial. But what I'm saying is I think the vast majority of clinics don't practice that.
That's borne out with the utilization. If you take a look at heart failure patients, very few of them end up on these MRAs. It's just not widely adopted.
Yeah, and the fear of hyperkalemia with MRA is very, very high, right? It, again, as nephrologists, we are not afraid of hyperkalemia, but most other people are. So, to Nayan's point, I'm sure that does play a huge part. And if there are ways to allay that fear and increase MRA use, you know, I agree that finerenone has brought, you know, has made aldosterone very attractive and glamorous again. So all credit to that for bringing aldo to the front.
You summarized it really well in the blog post on finerenone. So I think we should definitely post a link to that. I mean, I'm a bigger fan of spironolactone as anyone. I use a lot, but I think, you know, increasingly when I look at the discontinuation rates and the hyperkalemia rates in spironolactone trials compared to finerenone trials, they look like a totally different drug. And of course, you have to be a bit cautious because these are comparative effectiveness, different entry criteria. But maybe what ends up being different between the drugs in the end is the difference in the hyperkalemia rate. Obviously, we need more head-to-head data. But I didn't really think it was going to be much of a difference, but increasingly I'm starting to be convinced it is.
Brendan, related to that, can you touch on or do you have sort of thoughts on the mechanism for that or why that might be?
I don't know, Geordie. I think, as you know, Swap mentioned, there are differences in selectivity for the MR. If you look at the other drugs that block aldosterone, like the ASIs, they also cause increases in serum potassium. I think every drug that acts on the aldosterone axis is going to increase serum potassium. But why a drug that blocks the MR might be different to a drug that blocks the production of aldosterone in the first place, I don't know. I don't think anyone really knows.
That's helpful because I kept like racking my brain trying to understand why. And the only rationale I could convince myself of is that it's just such a lower dose and that perhaps it really is like a tenth of the potency of what you would get with spironolactone or eplerenone. And that could be why. I have not been able to find anything. I was hoping perhaps you had some inside knowledge.
You know, one of the interesting things about fine arts is the dose is double what we studied in Fidelio. It's, you know, up to 40 milligrams in patients with preserved kidney function GFR greater than 60. And from what I could see, the rates of hyperkalemia weren't that different at all, if not identical. I like Swapnil's back of the envelope calculation, but I think that the doses are different.
I was going to say, Brendan, I we need to be cautious about comparing rates of hyperkalemia when you have one study that has all diabetics and another study with 60% non-diabetics. Like, we just know that our patients with diabetes and diabetic kidney disease much more prone to hyperkalemia. And so I think that's why they felt comfortable going to that very high dose, is my guess.
Very true. Yeah.
I would like to say one thing. Heart failure with preserved ejection fraction or mildly reduced ejection fraction is the place that good drugs go to die. Right. We have seen ACE inhibitors fail here. Neprilysin inhibitor didn't meet its primary outcome, even though it's still accepted in the guidelines as an effective therapy because it hit some of its secondary outcomes. Spironolactone failed in its trial on its top line results. I know there's been reanalysis of that. Flozin's hit, right? Flozin's hits. GLP-1 receptor agonists, they hit. And this is a positive trial.
Can I talk about the background of HFpEF real quick? Because I don't think everybody knows that who's listening. And this is a HFpEF trial because it may be obvious to people, but heart failure with preserved ejection fraction is distinctly different than heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, right? All of these things that antagonize renin and angiotensin clearly don't work in heart failure with preserved ejection fraction because it's a heterogeneous disease. And I think for cardiologists, they get frustrated like we get frustrated with CKD getting lumped into one entity. And I think we've made the analogy on this podcast before that HFrEF is kind of like our diabetic kidney disease because we have our own pillars of GDMT. And HFpEF really feels like that non-proteinuric CKD where it, you know, we have very limited options and there's people like Dr. James Fang and others that have really dedicated their research to basically saying that HFpEF is a primary kidney disorder and that it's really all just type 4 cardiorenal syndrome. And to Joel's point, it wasn't until EMPEROR Preserved and DELIVER came out where we actually had medications for this. And those made it into the guidelines as 2A. And that's because when the guidelines were written, only Emperor Preserved was out. So I think they're going to get promoted with the next set of guidelines. But then to your point, Paragon, it was actually negative for primary and secondary outcomes. But somebody said, well, there's a p-value of 0.06. Maybe it's close enough. And so it got in there as a 2B. Same thing with the shenanigans with Topcat, which I'm sure we'll talk about more, gets in as a 2B. But Jordi can speak about this more eloquently than I can. It's pretty interesting that adipose tissue actually produces aldosterone and leptin, which increases aldosterone levels. So I think there was a lot of interest in MRAs, particularly with the obesity-associated HFpEF. And I think, you know, that probably led to Bayer being, you know, excited about testing finerenone in this population.
And so I'm going to jump in because we did the study in Topcat. So for those who aren't aware of Topcat, it's been mentioned in several of the NFJC discussions and anything where we bring up finerenone. But Topcat was a large-scale international randomized control trial of spironolactone versus placebo in patients with HFpEF, sort of. It was an older definition of HFpEF. And the results were negative, but this was attributed to the fact that there were several sites in Russia and Georgia, the country, not the state, that ended up enrolling patients that it turns out likely weren't eligible. They likely had either just pulmonary hypertension or COPD, some other pulmonary criteria that were producing their dyspnea, and never really met like the true criteria that we would normally use to define somebody as having HFpEF. And in addition, in post-hoc analyses that were done testing whether patients were actually adhering to the drug objectively, they found in blood samples that many people that were randomized to the spironolactone were never actually receiving it. And so this is all just very concerning about the conduct of the trial in those centers. And so post-hoc analyses demonstrated that in the Americas, North and South America, where the study had been conducted, all those sites found combined, they found a positive outcome that spironolactone was protective. We took it further and we tried to help with this issue as nephrologists about phenotyping HFpEF because the cardiologists were starting to get really frustrated saying this is not one disease. And so we used the data to identify different phenotypes. This had been done by Sanjeev Shah before us, and we corroborated that there are likely three, at least, phenotypes of HFpEF, one of which is like a true CKD obesity diabetic phenotype, which is what we're seeing likely is a huge part of this response from SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 agonists. Those patients responded the best to spironolactone. They had the worst outcomes. They ended up with the most heart failure hospitalizations and mortality, but they also had the greatest improvement in their heart failure from spironolactone. So just throwing that out there, I think that that was like one example of several that are representative of why these patients do have like a clear aldosterone component. We had biomarkers as well, and we found that those patients had higher aldosterone levels. They had more adipose tissue. So it all links from a mechanism standpoint as well.
Can I just say about the branding? Like, you have to admire these cardiologists, right? Like in nephrology, we argue like CKD3 is not even CKD, whereas they call it heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, right? Maybe we should have called it like, look at the gall, right? The heart function is preserved, but it's still heart failure. You know, we should say, and we argue that reduced GFR is not even CKD. You know, so imagine if we had CKD2 as CKD with preserved kidney function as a disease, right? It's impressive how heart cardiologists are able to, you know, capture everything within the cardiology umbrella.
Ejection fraction is far less riddled with challenges than EGFR is, though I will say that, as much as it has its issues.
I saw a nice quote on Twitter, I can't remember who said it, but said, you know, HFpEF is really a kidney disease. So I think it's very appropriate that we're talking about it on Freely Filtered. And, you know, if there was some nice data from Stanford, I think, that showed that, you know, in heart failure in our patients is dominated by far and away by HFpEF. So I think it's worth talking about HFpEF specifically because it's such a big part of our day-to-day practice.
And there was a great study in CRIC related to that, Brendan, where the chronic renal insufficiency cohort here in the US, so huge longitudinal cohort of patients with chronic kidney disease, where they found this huge, huge proportion of participants had poor KCCQ scores. Like they had poor quality of life according to the Kansas City Cardiomyopathy Questionnaire, which Swapnil will talk more about when describing the methods, was one of the outcomes in the Fine Arts study.
Just one more thing. Sorry. My personal view is that most people with advanced CKD have some form of HFpEF, but they're just undiagnosed.
I completely agree. I think I have a lot of HFpEF patients. I just don't know about it. So I was looking at the methods, You know, that is my way of talking about the method squeezing in, because you guys won't let me talk on methods, is that I was looking at the criteria saying, okay, let me see how people diagnose HFpEF. Maybe, you know, this is what I will do. So this was a large international multi-center parallel group, double-blind randomized trial. It was event-driven. So that's the sample size part that we'll come to later. Overall, you know, very, very simplistically, the TLDR version is that they had patients with ejection fraction more than 40%, and they had to have HFpEF, and they were randomized to finerenone or no finerenone, with outcomes being, you know, a measure of heart failure hospitalization. But let's dive a little bit deeper into some of these things. So the inclusion criteria were patients who had preserved ejection fraction or, you know, mildly reduced ejection fraction. So they had to have symptomatic heart failure, so NYHA 2 or more. And please interrupt me as I'm making, hopefully I'm not making many of these things up. And if it was a hospitalization, it could be in a shorter duration. But if it was not hospitalization, it could be a longer duration, like the past 90 days versus the past 30 days to have these symptoms. Plus, they had to have an elevated BNP. AFib, the BNP had to be, you know, 900. If they had did not have AFib, it could be 300. And the numbers are different for pro-BNP versus...
Which is interesting, because at least in our practice, we don't use BNP a lot in these patients. You know, obesity confounds it. There's a study showing that, you know, in maybe a majority of the patients, the BNP isn't elevated. So I found that interesting in this study. But I think for this, they wanted to be sure.
Mm-hmm. It was a requirement. Let's again, those are, I'm looking at those things in the reason, like, you know, maybe that's how I should be diagnosing HFpEF. So they had to be on diuretic treatment for at least 30 days. On this point of treatment, they did not specify other management. So they did not requiring RAS inhibition was not compulsory. And you can understand from the background that RAS inhibition is not 1A. It's, neither is Flozins in this case, but Flozins may have been because, you know, they came very recently in this area, nor was ARNI. So none of those things were requirement, so, or beta blockers either. So a lot of patients were on it, but they are not like the 100% that we expect to see in diabetic kidney disease, where we expect, you know, ACE inhibition rates to be close to 100%. So that was not a requirement. Of course, they could not be on a potassium sparing diuretic. They should not be on a spironolactone or any of the MRAs. If they had been on it, but they were not on it for 30 days or longer, then that could be enrolled in the trial. But, you know, if patients were stable on spironolactone, they did not, you know, stop it to get the patients on the trial. So going back to the HFpEF criteria, I got sidetracked with the medications. They had these structural heart abnormalities based on imaging, which is, you know, whatever kind of imaging, echo, MRI, which is done locally. And this is where, you know, I don't understand these things, but I guess they needed a large left atrium. And they needed left ventricular hypertrophy. So they have some LVMI criteria, and they need a septal thickness of, you know, there are some cardiology numbers in there and some acronyms that don't make sense to me, but I hope they make sense to Nayan and Jordi about the LAD, LAA, LAVI, and all those things.
Left atrial volume index. So if you have a dilated left atrium, it's a really common finding in HFpEF. That's as a result of the increased E to E prime ratios that you end up seeing, resulting in this increased pressure in the left atrium. It's all part of the diagnosis that we, as nephrologists, should probably get fluent in, because we probably are missing it a lot when we read echoes, because they don't just say, stage 1 diastolic dysfunction.
Right, exactly right. So again, this is not in the main paper, so do read the supplement for all the detailed descriptions.
Table S1 on page 31 of the supplement.
And then in terms of exclusion, the main one is a GFR of less than 25 was an exclusion. And they did, in the subgroups, they look at GFR less than 60, more than 60. And that's important also for the dosing. The rest of the exclusions are, you know, if they have hyperkalemia is an important exclusion. So potassium more than 5 was an exclusion, which is a little bit higher than, I think the Fidelio Figaro was 4.8. And they also had a run-in phase, which this trial did not have. So I think they, because, you know, as we discussed in the HFpEF population, the expectation of hyperkalemia is lower. So they decided to go up to 5. And they have, you know, the usual other exclusions. I don't think there's anything there that seems very exciting, apart from, you know, being on an MRA, being on dual RAS inhibition, being on a potassium sparing diuretic, those kind of things were excluded. Anything else on the population that you guys want to talk about?
What's the deal with age? Why age had to be over 40? That's a weird line. I see, you know, not under 18, sometimes they'll limit really old people, but age 40 being a minimum age, something I'm not familiar with.
Nan may have more insight into this than I do, but we do this for a lot of our HFpEF trials because you end up seeing a similar architecture in some of the congenital cardiomyopathies, and you don't want to misconstrue somebody as being HFpEF who's actually congenital cardiomyopathy.
And they're all dead by age 40, is that the idea?
They're all diagnosed by age 40.
Yeah, I think that's right. Especially if you have echocardiographic criteria, it's going to be hard to include those younger patients.
So in terms of intervention then, this was a higher dose. So they did start with 10 milligrams for GFR less than 60 and 20 milligrams for GFR more than 60. And then at the next visit, if the potassium was okay, creatinine hadn't dropped, they went up to 40 milligram or 20 milligrams. So the highest dose in those whose GFR was less than 60 was 20 milligrams. And those with GFR of more than 60, the aim was to escalate it to 40 milligrams. In the design, now again, there was a screening visit and a randomization visit. And if the potassium was more than 5 at any time, they were excluded, but they could, you know, be rescreened and included. But unlike Fidelio Figaro, there was no run-in phase. In the Fidelity trials, they got maximum RAS inhibition, and if they developed hyperkalemia, they were out. So that was a much cleaner population here. They were like, okay, you know, these patients are at low risk, no run-in period. But what happened then, which is in compared to the BARAC-D trial, which was a, you know, a pragmatic trial of spironolactone in CKD in the UK, which was, you know, very poorly done, I would say, in some respects, very pragmatic, not poorly done, is that in this case, they really monitored potassium and creatinine. And they said, hey, if this happens, let's do that. So for example, if the potassium went up to, was below 5, they would escalate that finerenone dose. If it was between 5 and 5.5, they would not do anything. If it was more than 5.5, they would hold it or reduce the dose. If they were on a higher dose, they would go to the lower dose. But if they were on the lowest possible dose, they would hold it. And then they would, the investigators were free to do whatever was possible in that area. They didn't prescribe saying, hey, use, you know, KXLate or sodium polystyrene sulfonate or sodium zirconium cyclosilicate or patiromer. They said, you know, do whatever is possible to fix the potassium, repeat it. And if the potassium is okay, it's less than 5.5, you can restart the finerenone. So I think that was a smart thing to do. So there was a really intensive monitoring of the potassium. Similarly for creatinine, if the creatinine went up to more than 25%, between 25 and 40%, they would say, hey, you know, reduce the dose of, if it is less than 25%, it's fine. If the GFR dropped more between 25 to 40%, the dose was reduced. Or if they were on the lowest dose, the dose was stopped. The 40% is interesting because 50% drop in GFR wasn't one of the kidney outcomes. So they are saying, hey, it's 40%, let's stop it. Let's get them out before they develop the kidney outcome. I'm just making that up. But it's interesting that they, you know, did the 40% as an exclusion. So I think these were, as Jordi said, this is a beautiful, elegant design. And I think these molecules are not easy. So you need really smart designs, which BARAC-D was not. I know we are not discussing BARAC-D, but I think a pragmatic trial like that failed because, you know, it was very loosey-goosey. With these molecules like spironolactone, finerenone, you need a really tight design and you need to monitor the creatinine and the potassium. You cannot just put people on it and walk away like you can do with Flozins.
Yeah, I think it's worth mentioning a point that Vlado brought up previously, which is our general instinctive approach in renal trials is to test the lowest possible dose because we are much more concerned about adverse drug reactions and the susceptibility of our patients to side effects. You know, the dose here is different to what we have seen in CKD progression trials of finerenone, 10 to 20 milligrams maximum dose. In fine CKD, which is non-diabetic kidney disease, again, it's 10 to 20 milligrams. I think it's very difficult to tease out the question that you raised earlier, Swapnil. Is there a dose equivalence with spironolactone? And maybe the investigators might look into that further, but it's still all post hoc. So it's hard to know whether or not this larger dose makes a difference and whether we should be using a different dose in CKD.
I remember the first time I saw this molecule was a JAMA article from forever ago. And it was a dose, it was a phase two dose finding study. There's definitely a dose response to this drug. The higher doses had definitely more reduction in proteinuria.
ARTS-DN by the late George Bakris.
Yeah. Oh, that's so hard to hear. I'm sorry. The late George Bakris.
But interestingly, although if you look in the trials, in the CKD trials, almost everyone gets up to 20 milligrams. But if you look at routinely collected data, it's actually the complete opposite. Most people are on 10 milligrams rather than going up to 20 milligrams. So it just shows you how what is done in a trial may not necessarily translate into what's done in clinical practice.
And so my theory on that was originally the cost and that you were going to get charged more for escalating dose, and that could be it. But then I recently uptitrated a patient and there was no change in the cost. It was identical. And so I actually then had to back titrate because she had an adverse response to the higher dose. And now she's just cutting it in half and paying half the price.
It's because titrating is hard. You need labs. You need follow-up. You need it's hard to do.
It's inertia. Yeah. And we have the same problem.
Yeah. Once you find a dose that they're stable on and they're not having an adverse response, okay, I've got them on finerenone. Check. Move along. Next.
Yeah. I mean, I do like the fire and forget approach, right, that we have with Flozins. That makes drug prescription so easy.
Oh, there was a poster at Kidney Week that suggested that you get more benefit with the higher dose, right? We've always thought that 10 milligrams of empagliflozin is as good as 25, but I think there's data out there that we could be wrong. I don't know if you guys know more than I do.
No, but I do think it all gets at our inertia as clinicians. We do this a ton, and this is where we see all of these, the hypertension world, how PharmDs do far better than MDs at getting patients under control because the PharmDs are willing to follow an algorithm to tell them, oh, the patient's not at goal, up titrate, whereas we get somebody on the drug and we're sort of just like patting ourselves on the back. We got them to take the medication. So I think that there's some self-reflection we need to do about where we could not be doing the best service to our patients. And if we still see that proteinuria number above where we want it, should we be pushing harder?
In the criteria, I forgot to mention that even CYP3A4, if someone was on a CYP3A4 inhibitor, then they were excluded. I wasn't aware, you know, embarrassingly, that finerenone is a substrate. So, you know, rifampin, if a patient was on the rifampin or ritonavir or fluconazole or what have you, that was one of the exclusion criteria. So that's something to keep in mind for drug interactions in the future. The randomization was stratified by ejection fraction more or less than 60% and geography, interestingly enough. I guess they were afraid of what happened with TopCat. So they had geography in there, which again, you know, it didn't matter here. But in terms of outcomes then, so the primary outcome was a composite of total worsening heart failure events and cardiovascular death. So if I'm not wrong, that total worsening heart failure events includes first or recurrent unplanned hospitalization or urgent visit for heart failure. So does this mean from, you know, what you guys read that one patient could have multiple heart failure events
and they would be counted? Yeah. More events than patients, right?
Yes.
Right. So a patient wasn't excluded.
It's usually time to first event. Yeah. That's usually the outcome we get in these heart failure with preserved ejection fractions.
So I guess, you know, people could contribute more events. Then there were many subsequent outcomes. And they had like a hierarchical testing algorithm for that, which is, you know, we are seeing more and more commonly. One was total worsening heart failure events alone. Then the change in baseline in the symptom score on the KCCQ, which from 0 to 100, which I'm not familiar with. I know it's very commonly used. It's a symptom score. So I'm happy to be educated again. I think we have discussed it on a previous heart failure freely filtered podcast, but I think it's a very well-validated symptom score in heart failure that we need not necessarily go into.
Basically, a higher score is better, lower score is worse.
This is the one that's expensive and the guy sues you if you use it?
Exactly right, from Missouri or somewhere.
Yeah. Probably Kansas City is my guess.
Yeah.
This is the same one I was mentioning in the chronic renal insufficiency cohort, that our patients score horribly on this. They tend to show that they have very, very low quality of life scores. So, and it's all very heart failure focused. It's like, how much has your dyspnea affected your day-to-day activities and prevented you from doing what you like to do? And do you know what you should do if it gets worse and who to contact are the sorts of questions. It's a lot of like self-insight into what's happening. And so kidney patients tend to across the board do horribly. And to Brendan's point earlier, probably reflective of most of our patients having undiagnosed HFpEF.
Exactly right. So after the KCCQ, they had the improvement in NYHA functional class at 1 year, and then they had the kidney composite outcome. So the kidney composite outcome for the main trial was a sustained decline in GFR of 50%. Again, 50% is interesting. You know, these days, 30%, 40%, everything is now validated, even GFR slope. But for the big trial, they had 50%, or a decline of to less than 15, or initiation of long-term dialysis or kidney transplant, right? So that was the composite kidney outcome for the main trial. We'll also go into the kidney outcome trial, which was published in JACC at Kidney Week. And in that, apart from these, they also did, they looked at 57% decline in GFR, which is the doubling of creatinine. They also then looked at a GFR slope, and they looked at changes in albuminuria. So albuminuria is a, you know, is a continuous outcome and or development or worsening of albuminuria from persistent, you know, to micro to macro albuminuria. So those are the kidney outcomes that they looked at in the JACC paper.
Just a quick comment about the endpoints. If just taking a broader picture, if you look at heart failure trials 10 or 15 years ago, the heart failure trialists pretty much exclusively thought about kidney outcomes as a safety event, as an adverse event. They were generally reported as investigator-reported adverse events. They were different from every trial. No one knew what worsening kidney function means, worsening renal function. And I guess part of the reason why we can talk about this trial on Freely Filtered is because what the heart failure community have done has essentially borrowed all of our endpoints from kidney trials and then applied them to heart failure trials. So we're now kind of speaking the same language in terms of endpoints. The endpoints that you see here are effectively the same as in flow, for example. And so I think that allows us to better understand the effects of different drugs, particularly heart failure drugs, on the kidney.
And then, Brendan, can you talk a little bit about the acute versus chronic EGFR assessment that was done here? Because I think that this is something that was done in some of the SGLT2 inhibitor studies, or all of them as well, and that it's sort of a nice, elegant way of looking at it that I think the heart failure docs are getting more and more nuanced into the nephrology literature.
Yeah, absolutely. Geordie, like the other finerenone trials and other SGLT2 inhibitor trials, we know that finerenone causes a predictable acute reduction in GFR, about 3 mils per minute, and that occurs essentially immediately after taking the drug, and that effect is different to the long-term effect. So here, what the investigators have done, again, is the same as what was done in the SGLT2 inhibitor trials, looked at the acute effect in the first few weeks of treatment, and then looked at the chronic effect, which excludes that acute effect. And then overall looked at the total effect, which includes both the acute and the chronic component. Now, the question really is, what is the right definition of slope to evaluate kidney disease progression, particularly in heart failure? And in kidney disease, now we have data from the CKD Clinical Trials Consortium that suggests that total slope, that includes both the acute and chronic components, probably performs better than chronic slope, because chronic slope may introduce bias by ignoring the first few weeks of treatment. And if you look at total slope here, there is about 1 mil per minute per year worse GFR with finerenone compared to placebo. And that kind of lines up with the hazards ratio for the kidney outcome being above 1 in this case. So I think there's more, we're doing work to across all of the heart failure trials to validate which definition of GFR slope is the best to assess kidney disease progression in heart failure. I suspect the total slope is probably going to outperform chronic slope, but we'll hopefully have that data out in 2025.
And on those outcomes, I'm curious about the kidney outcomes from, say, Paragon and TopCat. I know Nayan probably knows that, but maybe we can hold that for the results. When we discuss the results, we can, you know, compare the kidney outcomes from those trials as well. You know, going back to the outcomes, they had adverse events, you know, the typical adverse events, but also hyperkalemia and AKI in the outcomes of interest to us. And the analysis itself was pretty straightforward. Like Joel said, it's an RCT, right? It's nothing complicated. So they had, they wanted to have 2,375 primary outcome events. So it was an event-driven trial. And again, you know, this seems like a high number, but it's probably also driven by the fact that heart failure hospitalization, especially when you're counting recurrent events, is not that uncommon in heart failure trials. So this is not a HFrEF, it's a HFpEF trial. And that would give them 90% power to detect a 19% lower event rate for the primary outcome. The rest of it is, you know, again, intent to treat analysis, stratified according to those two things. They did do two interim analysis, and the, you know, that was taken into account for the power analysis. And they looked at 17 pre-specified subgroups, which is, you know, an interestingly high number. And really, that's all I had to have for methods. And I have finished in record time.
All right, should we get into results?
Anybody have any other comments on the methods? We cool here.
I would just say again, you know, to your point and Jordy's point, it's really elegant, right? This is, again, not as rigorous is for the hyperkalemia aspect as the fidelity trials were, but they do put in a lot of safeguards. They spend a lot of money having these repeat results and, you know, do this, do that, which is what is needed in a MRA trial.
Help me out. So this was 6,000 subjects for 2.5 years. What's the scale? How big was TopCat?
I think TopCat Americas is about 1,600 people or so from memory.
Yeah, the total TopCat was about 3,500.
And Paragon was over a little over 4,800.
So this is bigger than any of these. And they move, and they also change the outcome so that you can get multiple outcomes for patients, which also presumably increases the power of your analysis. So, you know, it's interesting to see clinical trial has kind of learned from failed attempts in the past and are like, let's make sure if we have a more marginal effect than we expect, that we'll still be able to capture something.
Yeah, these were closer to the SGLT2 inhibitor trials, which were around 6,000 for both Deliver and Ember Preserved.
Yeah, that's right. And just a quick comment about the recurrent events analysis versus time to first events analysis. So, of course, in a recurrent events analysis, you're going to have more events. The event rate is going to be higher. You'd think that will give you more statistical power to detect a treatment effect. And that's why this was done and is done in other heart failure trials too. But in recent analyses, when they've compared the recurrent events analysis to the traditional time to first event analysis, it generally gives you a pretty similar result. And that was the case here too. So even though you get more events and higher event rates, what has been demonstrated, at least so far in the trials, is you get a pretty similar result.
Look at Brendan just walk all over AC's result. You know, it's like, AC, you know, you get no respect.
Sorry.
Okay. AC, hit it. What do we got for results?
All right. So they ultimately randomized 6,016 people to finerenone or placebo. This was across 654 sites in 37 countries from September of 2022 to January of 2023. They did exclude one patient who underwent randomization twice in error. And then there were 13 patients from one site that were excluded because of violations of good clinical practice guidelines.
Did they name the site?
Probably Italy.
So they ultimately had 6,001 patients included in the analysis, and the trial ran through June of 2024. By the end of it, 13 patients had withdrawn consent and 6 were lost to follow-up, and the median duration of follow-up was 32 months. And then just overall, I think we touched on this a little bit, but the groups appeared to be relatively balanced. So the mean ejection fraction was 53%. The majority were NYHA functional class 2, and about 20% were enrolled within 7 days after a heart failure event. Just in terms of at baseline, 85% were on beta blockers, 36% on ACE inhibitors, 35% on ARBs, and then I believe it was 8.5 that were on
ARNIs.
Yeah. Do I have that number right? 8.5 that were on ARNIs.
So, I mean, sorry, if you put them all together, it's like, it's still less than 90%, right? It's like 80, 85%.
Yes. Yeah. It's a little, yes. It's actually just under 80%. And then 13.6 were on an SGLT2 inhibitor. So there were 1,083 primary outcome events, which was, as we said, a composite of total worsening heart failure events and death from cardiovascular causes. And it occurred in 624 of the 3,003 patients in the finerenone group, and then 1,283 primary outcome events in 719 of the 2,998 patients in the placebo group. So kind of like we talked about, you can have more than one event per patient. The number of events is higher than the number of patients.
And just to go back to table one real quick, those numbers are very similar to other trials. The EF, the GFR, all of those things, blood pressure were very similar amongst the HFpEF trials.
I was surprised that the EF was that high, that they had to have at least an EF of, was it 40 or 45%?
40, greater than 40.
40. So they were significantly higher than that. They weren't trying to sneak in reduced ejection fraction into this trial.
Yeah, and that's similar to other trials. I think what you want to avoid is where you've seen with some other drugs where they're only positive in that mildly reduced ejection fraction. And so I think they're trying to make sure they avoid that mistake.
Okay.
So for that primary outcome event, the rate ratio was 0.85 with a confidence interval of 0.74 to 0.95. And then one patient in each group who had worsening heart failure and died from cardiovascular causes on the same day. And for those, it was only the fatal event that was counted. So they didn't kind of double count that day. The total number of worsening heart failure events was 842 in the finerenone group and 1,024 in the placebo group. And the rate ratio there was 0.82. And again, with a confidence interval of 0.71 to 0.94, and then 242 patients, which is 8.1% in the finerenone group, and 260 patients, which is 8.7% in the placebo group, died from cardiovascular causes. So the hazard ratio there was 0.93, and that 95% interval did cross one, so 0.78 to 1.11. The results for the primary outcome were consistent across all of those pre-specified subgroups that SWAP was mentioning, including the ejection fraction greater or less than 60%, and then baseline use of an SGLT2 inhibitor. In terms of the symptom score, the change from baseline symptom score was estimated at 6 months, 9 months, and 12 months. And it was roughly 8 in the finerenone group and roughly 6.5 in the placebo group. So the difference was 1.6 points with a 95% confidence.
Did you see where there, what that baseline score was? Like, how much is this a change from? Were they, you know what I mean? You see what I'm saying? Like, we see the delta, but we don't see where the level started at. What's the average KCCQ?
It's not in table one.
It's not in table one. That's exactly what I was looking for.
But that's change from baseline, right? That they're reporting.
Yeah.
You want the absolute number?
That's what I was kind of wondering. Yeah.
The mean KCCQ score at baseline was 68 in the finerenone arm and 67 in the placebo arm. So the same. And then what you see is an improvement in both arms by 6.4 in placebo and 8 in finerenone average, which gives you a between group difference of 1.6. So there is a statistically significant moderate effect or improvement in KCCQ.
But it's a scale from 0 to 100, and the delta between the two is 1.6. I mean, it's just...
Is that meaningful? Like, can anyone comment on what that means?
Yeah, in other trials, another way to look at it is, you know, the proportion of individuals who experience a greater than 5-point change in KCCQ. I think those data have actually been presented, although I haven't read the results. I think it's out there as well. And I suspect that there was an improvement in, or more individuals who experienced a 5-point improvement in KCCQ.
And what do you attribute the improvement in KCCQ in the placebo group? Do you think they were getting better background therapy? Were other drugs being improved? Or
yeah, we see this in every trial in the placebo arm. Often we see blood pressure improve in the placebo arm of SGLT2 inhibitor trials. We see body weight reductions that improve in the placebo arm of GLP-1 trials. And I think part of this is maybe improvements in, you know, care related to participation in the trial. People who are in the trial might be more focused on improving their health or adhering to specific treatments. So I think that underscores the importance of having a placebo arm.
Yeah, for sure.
Something interesting is the NYHA class is obviously a much blunter tool because it's only got four categories. But also interestingly, something I learned at ASN, there was a whole session on HFpEF, and there was a great talk by a cardiologist who works in this space who was talking about exercise tolerance in HFpEF. And he mentioned that the New York Heart Association classes are physician determined and the KCCQ is patient described. And that those are not even like often an overlapping Venn diagram. Like they are often completely orthogonal to each other with like a small little overlapping area. That physicians tend to judge patients like exercise tolerance and ability to function much differently than the patient perceives their own exercise tolerance. I just thought that was fascinating. And so here you see that both groups had about an 18% improvement, very similar. It was slightly better in the finerenone group from a physician standpoint. So firstly, that tells you, it's great, the blinding actually worked. But secondly, and it's just fascinating to me because it's different than what you end up seeing in the KCCQ.
Okay, cool.
Do we tend to think their functional status is better or worse than the patients think it is?
Just different.
Just different?
I think just quite different.
Kind of all over the map. That's interesting.
But it's one of those patient-reported outcomes, right? Which is so important rather than physician-reported outcomes.
Yeah, and I think this is something we need to do better in renal trials. I like how in the heart failure trials, you know, functional outcomes are key secondary endpoints. And I think we probably need to move more to that focus in CKD trials. The question then becomes, what is the right tool to measure functional status and quality of life in CKD patients? But my personal view is that, you know, the KCCQ score captures a lot of the symptoms of CKD anyway, at least in advanced CKD related to heart failure.
But nephrologists may not be able to afford it for our trials.
We do have the KDQOL, right? The Kidney Disease Quality of Life short form, 14 pages, 36 questions.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the thing is, I wonder if the way we have designed the KDQOL is not the same as KCCQ. Again, I'm not a quality measurement guy at all, but I've not seen any kidney quality of life score trials to have any positive effect. So it's really hard to find any effect in the quality of life scales in kidney disease. So I wonder if our tools are a little bit blunt and KCCQ is a bit, you know, smarter or better in some ways.
It's very different. Especially the components where they ask people like introspectively, like, do you feel confident in like how you would handle things if they got worse? And I think that's a big one where our patients probably don't necessarily identify us as the person that they would contact if their symptoms got worse.
Yeah. So like Jordy mentioned, in terms of improvement in the NYHA functional class at 12 months, it was about 18% in both groups. And then getting into the kidney composite outcome, so that was a sustained decrease in estimated GFR greater than or equal to 50%, or sustained decline in GFR to less than 15, or initiation of long-term dialysis or kidney transplant, and that was assessed in time to event. And the event occurred in 75 patients, so 2.5% in the finerenone group and 55 patients, or 1.8% in the placebo group. The hazard ratio of 1.33, but the confidence interval was 0.94 to 1.89. And then a total of 491 patients, or 16.4% in the finerenone group, and 522 patients, which is 17.4% in the placebo group, died from any cause. And the hazard ratio there was 0.93, with a confidence interval of 0.83 to 1.06. And then just kind of talking about safety a little bit, so of the patients who got at least one dose, roughly 20%, so similar rates in both groups, discontinued for reasons other than death. And then at the end of the trial, among the patients who were continuing therapy, it was 68.4% in the finerenone group and 78.4% in the placebo group were taking what was deemed to be their individualized target dose.
I just wanted to point out that what Brendan had talked about is that this traditional heart failure outcome is first worsening heart failure or death from cardiovascular cause. It's the last line in table 2. Hazard ratio is 0.84, which is exactly what the hazard ratio was for their primary outcome of the total worsening heart failure events and death from cardiovascular cause. So just like Brendan said, even though they had a different outcome, when you looked at it by the traditional outcome, same result, same strength. Sorry about that, AC.
No, not at all. Thank you. I think that's a good thing to point out. So in terms of serious adverse events, it was 38.7% in the finerenone group and 40.5% in the placebo group. And the increases in creatinine and potassium were more common with finerenone. So potassium levels greater than 6 occurred in 3% of the patients in the finerenone group and 1.4% of patients in the placebo group. So overall, still relatively small numbers. No episodes of hyperkalemia that led to death. And then in terms of hyperkalemia that even led to hospitalization, it only occurred in 0.5% in the finerenone group and 0.2% in the placebo group.
But less hypokalemia, which I love that they reported that.
Yes, they did. So they reported on hypokalemia less than 3.5. And yes, that was less common with finerenone.
I mean, hypokalemia is bad. Can we talk about the kidney outcomes from the Jack paper, the subsequent one as well?
Yes, let's do it. And then I guess the last thing from this one before we move on to Jack was just the mean systolic blood pressure at 6 months was lower in the finerenone group compared to placebo.
How much?
So the difference was 3.4 with the confidence interval of 2.6 to 4.2. So pretty modest. Yeah, very small. So then what happened is another group looked at the data and specifically examined kidney outcomes. And so here they were looking at the effects of finerenone on the secondary kidney outcome that we mentioned, in addition to some other outcomes. So the first kidney outcome that we had mentioned, which was the secondary outcome in fine arts, was a sustained eGFR decline less than 15, initiation of dialysis or kidney transplant. But then they also reported on a sustained greater than 57% decline in eGFR or kidney failure. They reported on eGFR slope and then changes in urine albumin to creatinine ratio. So here they looked at the same 6,001 patients. The baseline eGFR was 62 and 48% had an eGFR of less than 60. Pretty wide range. But overall, 5,797 had baseline urine albumin to creatinine ratio, and the median there was 18 milligrams per gram. So over the 2.5 years of follow-up, the incidence of the composite in kidney outcome was the same, obviously, as in fine arts. It's the same outcome, same data. But in terms of the other things that they looked at, so they found that for the composite of greater than 57% eGFR decline or kidney failure, it was 41 versus 31 events with a hazard ratio of 1.28 and a confidence interval of 0.8 to 2.05. So just a relatively low event frequency. So relatively low occurrence of that happening. And then during the first 3 months, finerenone led to the acute decline of eGFR, a decline of 2.9 with a confidence interval of negative 3.4 to negative 2.4.
Yeah, what are they measuring here?
Well, so here it's just in that first, this is the first 3 months. So first they're looking at the acute decline in eGFR after starting finerenone. Mm-hmm. Then they look at chronic slope and then they look at total slope. So in terms of just that acute decline, so the first 3 months after you start, during the first 3 months, they found an acute decline in the eGFR in the finerenone group of 2.9. So three.
Yeah. And then placebo didn't change like 0.1.
But it didn't alter the chronic eGFR slope versus the placebo. So chronic eGFR slope was the same. And then the difference in total slope was negative 0.7.
Yeah, because of the acute slope being worse, the total slope was worse for finerenone. And the chronic slope was no better, placebo versus finerenone. Just to restate, sorry. Unlike the Flozin trials where, you know, the acute slope is bad, but the chronic slope is better. So the total slope comes out to be better, especially with a long duration of follow-up. In this case, that did not happen.
Even things like GLP-1s, right? Didn't we see that in flow?
Right.
Yeah. The total slope in here was, you know, 0.7 mils per minute per year in favor of placebo, so worse for finerenone. If you look at data from other MRA trials in heart failure, emphasis HF, which is HFrEF, that was the total slope was minus 1.8 mils per minute per year. And in TopCat, it's minus 2.5 mils per minute per year. And I'm not suggesting that we do cross-trial comparisons, but just to give you an idea of what the other MRAs in heart failure, what their effects on total slope are. You can see they're all producing long-term effects that are slightly deleterious.
Worse.
Yeah.
So it may be good for the heart, but it's bad for the kidney.
But I think to your point, you know, Brendan, when you had talked about, you know, kind of looking at these kidney outcomes in these heart failure trials, if ultimately your cause of death primarily is going to be cardiovascular causes, does that mild kind of decrement in total slope really make that much of a difference overall? And I think we can talk about that, but.
Well, let's be clear, there was no cardiovascular mortality benefit here.
No effect on cardiovascular death. But, you know, this is the same across all the HFpEF trials, no effect on cardiovascular death, partly because the mode of death in HFpEF is different to HFrEF. If you look at HFrEF, like the large proportion of deaths are cardiovascular related. In HFpEF, it's much more heterogeneous, like in CKD. So a therapy that only affects one component of that CV death is less likely to demonstrate an effect overall. But we're getting into the weeds a bit.
Just to add to that, if you look at analyses of the some of the negative HFpEF trials like TopCat, where they reanalyze them looking at heart failure and all-cause mortality instead of cardiovascular death, you end up seeing a lot more positive outcomes. And a lot of the post-hoc analyses end up doing that, partially for that reason and partially because there's concern about misclassification bias of cardiovascular death in general, because it's like, which one are you picking when they die of PEA arrest, the pneumonia that they had or the PEA arrest?
Yeah, I mean, HFpEF is more insidious. You don't see those deaths as common as you do with HFrEF. Even things like DELIVER and everything didn't show mortality benefit with SGLT2 inhibitors in this population.
Or even if not mortality benefit, which, like you're saying, is kind of subject to classification issues. If we're seeing people have, you know, fewer hospitalizations or perhaps improvement in their symptoms, although, again, I think we'd kind of need to see like what the data is in terms of people that have had a more significant change rather than just like a point. But I think, you know, it's ultimately going to be kind of weighing, you know, is there a cardiovascular benefit and what that cardiovascular benefit is? Because it is a pretty modest change, I would argue, in the slope, and then no change in really the chronic slope.
What we've been discussing is most strikingly shown in the Fine Hearts meta-analysis, in which there was no reduction or no significant reduction in cardiovascular death, but total mortality was reduced in a kind of a weird flipping around there. And, you know, the great thing about total mortality is it captures everything, right? You don't have this attribution bias.
And to sort of get at some of the work that Brendan's done too, is like, there may be a synergy here and there may be something where this is the new GDMT and that you're not just looking at one drug, you're looking at how they all help on top of each other. One really interesting thing is, based off of the time period of this trial, only, 2-3% of people were on GLP-1 agonists at the time. If this trial were reinitiated right now, that number would be very different. And I think it will eventually be really interesting to see whether or not finerenone has an added benefit once you add it to a GLP-1 agonist, if you end up getting this cascade of benefit because of these different targeted therapies.
I mean, weren't you set up to not see kidney outcome benefit here? You have a median EGFR of 60, over 60, and 18 milligrams of albuminuria. I mean, I think we all could have predicted that they weren't going to see much, right, with those baseline characteristics.
Yeah, I think it's worth unpicking the kidney data, just in general, the neutral results, talking about that in the context of other heart failure trials, including SGLT2 inhibitor trials. One of the challenges, I think, in demonstrating a benefit with proven kidney protective drugs in heart failure is that the rates of CKD progression are much slower. This is a low-risk population, and what that means is that any acute reduction in GFR in the active arm, they're more likely to contribute to events or kidney events, so lead to a suggestion of harm. And because the background rate of progression is slow in the placebo arm, there's less time to overcome that acute effect. The second point is that if you look at rates of cardiovascular death or mortality in heart failure trials, there's several orders of magnitude higher than kidney disease progression. The kidney event rate is very, very low. And so there is this issue of competing mortality risk. And what renal trials have done to overcome this is we lump in cardiovascular death in our renal CKD progression outcome, like in FLOW, like in DAPA-CKD, like in CREDENCE. But if you do that in a heart failure trial, then 90% of your composite events will be the cardiovascular endpoints, and you're going to tell nothing about the kidney event. And I think the third point to recognize is that maybe the mechanisms of kidney disease progression are different in heart failure patients than they are in ambulatory CKD patients. We know that in heart failure, central venous pressures and back pressure may play a bigger role, whereas we're much more focused on intraglomerular hypertension. And maybe intraglomerular hypoperfusion is more prevalent in heart failure, and drugs that predominantly focus on this mechanism of disease progression may have less predictable benefits in heart failure. So I think there are a number of reasons why, as an said, we shouldn't be surprised that there is no benefit here observed with a proven kidney protective therapy. If you even look at SGLT2 inhibitor drugs and heart failure trials, the effects on kidney outcomes are pretty modest, and with the exception of EMPA reduced, they're all neutral. And if you look at ARBs in heart failure, again, the same signal, you see actually more harm with the ARB. So every drug class that we know protects the kidney has not shown benefit in heart failure trials. And I think those are some of the probable explanations.
I do think it's interesting that the one outcome that was positive was reduction in new onset macroalbuminuria. And I think that's how GLP-1 agonist started. I think it was liraglutide. That was the main finding from a renal perspective, was reduction in new onset macroalbuminuria. And that, obviously, look where we are now. So,
yeah, but it's not like you can't take albuminuria to the bank, unlike, say, in diabetic kidney disease or in IgA nephropathy. I think HFpEF, as Brendan pointed out, the albuminuria in HFpEF, again, it's a really, really small amount. It's not like the, 300, 200 ACR that we are used to in diabetic kidney disease. It's what median was 18. So it's a really different.
Yeah, but in epidemiologic studies, we do see signals for albuminuria right down to zero, like 5 is worse than 1 and 10 is worse than 5. Like even in the normal range, that albuminuria is toxic.
Right. So albuminuria is toxic, but does not mean reducing albuminuria is protective.
We do not know that. That is correct.
In this population, it may not be true. In HFpEF, it may not be true, perhaps.
A good example is the neprilysin inhibitors, which increase albuminuria but have reduced kidney events.
Can you tell me more about that? So is that the Paragon?
That's both Paragon and Paradigm. When you combine those, you can see UACRs go up, but kidney events go down, presumably because, again, you're treating the heart, which is better for the kidneys in patients with heart failure.
And who cares about what the cause of the albuminuria?
Though some of it, I think, gets at hyperfiltration and how long and protracted of an event that is. And if you're hyperfiltering the kidneys, you can have many years of an excellent looking EGFR that then gets unmasked by some event and you're seeing the true EGFR. And we think that that's often what happens when we introduce RAS blockade, is that we're unmasking a true EGFR in a hyperfiltration circumstance. So why couldn't that be the case here? And that, I mean, we may be seeing that acute decline that's representative of that. And then a failure to see a benefit over time because we've just unmasked the truth of what the person's underlying kidney function was. And there's just not enough time to see a benefit because it's 2.6 years of follow-up and it's going to take 5-10 years to see that effect.
Yeah, it's quite possible. All those scenarios are possible. But again, you know, bottom line is that in HFpEF, MRAs don't seem to have a kidney benefit. Again, you know, it doesn't mean we should not use them. You use them, you just have to be clear that you're using them for the cardiovascular benefit, mostly hospitalization for heart failure. Don't expect if the proteinuria goes down that you will see a kidney benefit necessarily, unless, you know, maybe over 10 years you might. So make sure you're using it for the right reason. This doesn't change what we do.
A swap, I think you need to slow your roll there. These drugs clearly in diabetic kidney disease, clear wins for the kidney.
Yeah.
We have the study coming out. Brandon's study, the FIND trial? What are you doing, Brandon? What's that?
FIND CKD.
We're going to see if they work in non-diabetic kidney disease. I'm happy to put my money down right now saying that's going to be a positive trial. I think it's going to work.
But it's FIND CKD is proteinuric CKD, right? It's not non-proteinuric.
No, I get it. And let's not make a big deal about patients that don't achieve kidney outcomes. This drug doesn't reduce kidney outcomes in a population that doesn't get kidney outcomes. I'm not sure if I care, right?
It also comes down to the proteinuria. We don't see that ACE inhibitors and ARBs necessarily reduce adverse kidney events in people with chronic kidney disease that are non-proteinuric. We only see that benefit necessarily in people who are proteinuric, thinking back to the ASK trial. And so I think—
Look at Jordy completely reverse herself. Last week on the podcast, she has her mentee showing that ACE inhibitor—
They are beneficial to the heart. So her research has shown that they are beneficial to the heart in non-proteinuric kidney disease. But her poster at ASN that is not yet published showed that they are not beneficial to kidney outcomes. They are beneficial for mortality. Beneficial. They are associated with better mortality and associated with lower cardiovascular outcomes. But
my apologies.
That matches.
Sounds like finerenone so far.
Yeah.
Finerenone, a more expensive ACE inhibitor. They should try that line.
And part of it could be that you might need to follow these people for 30 years to see the kidney benefit.
And I don't know if we mentioned it, but I think the last point is the only other proven therapy in HFpEF is the SGLT2 inhibitors. And across all of these outcomes, the effects of finerenone were consistent regardless of SGLT2 inhibitor, with the caveat that, you know, there was a small number of people on SGLT2 inhibitors at baseline.
I think that's the hard thing with, for example, heart failure with preserved ejection fraction is, you know, with diabetic kidney disease, at least in my mind, it's a little easier for me to figure it out, right? But you get people on RAS inhibitors, put them on SGLT2 inhibitors. If they have residual albuminuria, I reach for maybe not, you know, non-steroidal MRAs. With heart failure, it's a little harder because you're relying on symptoms without really any objective signs.
And the other thing that the finerenone has done, we talked about how it has made MRAs, you know, people look at MRAs again, and hopefully it'll increase the use of MRAs overall. But there's also this all research on ASIs, the aldosterone synthase inhibitors, that's happening on the side. And that's, you know, rapidly coming free. But the first couple of trials, phase 2 trials, were in hypertension with baxdrostat and lorundrostat. But there is a BI agent, which now has a name, vicardostat, I think. They are doing Easy Kidney, which is an 11,000 patient, you know, empagliflozin plus vicardostat trial, which is amazing. And even AstraZeneca is doing a baxdrostat trial in CKD, not just in hypertension. I think Arctic or Pacific or maybe both are those kind of hard outcome trials. So it's really fantastic that A, Aldo has become cool again, but B, we are having the cardiology-like trials happening, you know, in multiple areas in nephrology. These are, you know, 10,000, 11,000 patient trials that, you know, we are not used to. We are used to, you know, 20 patient, 80 patient trials. So this is phenomenal that this is a renaissance of trials in nephrology.
How many patients were on that 2001 spironolactone and allopro trial? 12, maybe?
I think so.
Swap, are you enrolling for Easy Kidney? Are you a PI there?
No, we haven't been approached yet.
We are enrolling.
Oh, wow. Wow. It started recently.
Yeah. It's easy enrolling. It's a broad enrollment.
Easy Kidney is easy.
It's right. Do you have any CKD patients? Oh, we got a few.
And again, the Flozin plus ASI is such a, you know, again, the hyperkalemia may perhaps be better, right? So that's the other key thing.
Yeah,
maybe if instead of 13% they had, you know, 100% on Flozins, then the hyperkalemia signal would not have been there at all.
Yeah, so lots of activity in the aldosterone space. Fine CKD is 1,600 people with non-diabetic CKD, proteinuric CKD, about half of whom have a glomerular disease, 400 patients with IgA nephropathy. Then finerenone is also being evaluated in type 1 diabetes as well in the FINE 1 trial. That's an albuminuria lowering trial in type 1 diabetes. We, you know, I think in some ways we've neglected the type 1 patients with all the SGLT2 inhibitor and other therapies. And so that's an important trial. And also finerenone is being evaluated across the spectrum of ejection fraction with simultaneous initiation with an SGLT2 inhibitor and in patients with HFrEF who are intolerant of a steroidal MRA. So there's lots of data coming out for finerenone in the future, hopefully, and also with the aldosterone synthase inhibitor trials that you've mentioned, Swaf.
Yeah, I think they also have Confidence, which is finerenone with a aflozin, perhaps.
Yes, that's right. I think that's an important trial, Confidence, because it's, you know, we're starting to talk about rapid sequence guideline-directed therapy for diabetic kidney disease. And the real challenge is, how do we do that effectively and safely? Is it safe to do this all at the same time or in a short time frame? And Confidence is doing that. It's testing starting empagliflozin and finerenone on the same day in patients with diabetic kidney disease. And so it will be important. I think, you know, in that trial, the safety and acute kidney injury data will be at least as interesting to nephrologists as the efficacy data. We know it's obviously going to be positive, we think, from an albuminuria lowering perspective, but it's really important because I think it will engender confidence in simultaneous initiation, or at least more rapid initiation.
At least provide us data.
I'm really curious because I see all the, I mean, again, I always go back to the hypertension space, but we see all of these fixed dose combination trials that have come out showing patients adhere more, that you get more effective blood pressure lowering. And yet you see that on a national level, like no one's using them and everyone starts people on monotherapy even when they're very uncontrolled. So I'm so curious if we're going to, even if we get the data, are people going to do it? Maybe they will because it's not considered like an old dog with old tricks. Like maybe it's really thought to be something more exciting and novel, but I worry about just clinicians in general being scared and really falling into inertia.
Do we have any other wrap up or important points about this trial?
I think we have discussed whatever we wanted to discuss. I think Nayan's viewpoint and Jordi and my viewpoint is not that far apart. Though we like to argue, I think, you know, we are all on the same page that we should be using more MRAs, whether they're MRAs or NSMRAs. And, you know, again, Nayan, in Canada also, we do have finerenone. We are not stuck with captopril and spironolactone. Finerenone is not only available, but it is approved and it is covered only for diabetic kidney disease presently.
But do you use it?
Yeah, we have. I've used it more than once.
You know, like I was saying, in our cardiorenal clinic, every patient with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction gets spironolactone, assuming their potassium can handle it. And the question is, you know, do we need to change our practice based on this? And I don't know that that's clear because, you know, we believe that spironolactone's just as good based on the TopCat results. So it'll be interesting to see how this changes practice across the country.
I do think, though, to your point, I think more people are just going to reach for this class in general. Like I will say, as someone who's still and forever in training right now, like I see so many people just like start an ACE inhibitor now, you know, starting SGLT2 inhibitors. But if the proteinuria is still not under control, just throwing up their hands and basically saying like, I did what I can do. And I do think that this renewed excitement, whichever one you reach for, I think is a good thing.
I worry, though. I think people are going to be reticent to still reach for spironolactone and eplerenone because I think studies like BARACTI do give it a bad name and that people are worried and that there's a lot of sort of bad press going around that they're not that great. And we forget, like Matt Wire just put out a great trial that was in Circulation showing spironolactone improved cardiac architecture. Like it was a great mechanistic trial and reduced left ventricular mass. It was something where it was all patients with chronic kidney disease and diabetes. It was exactly this group of patients, and our patients do benefit. I think that we do need to look deeply at this and think it's until we can maybe afford finerenone for everybody of people who don't have the insurance coverage that we shouldn't just, okay, throw up our hands and not give them finerenone, that spironolactone and eplerenone really are great options for these patients. 90% of patients with HFpEF have hypertension. They should all be on something in these classes. And just thinking about how many of our patients likely fall into the HFpEF category alone, they could benefit a huge amount from a cardiac standpoint.
It is interesting that spironolactone is very different in this population, whereas in HFrEF, people who don't typically have hypertension, it doesn't tend to impact blood pressure.
Yeah.
But HFpEF, very different in terms of the demographic.
And I wish there was a 6.25 of spironolactone, right? Like, we are comfortable giving spironolactone, or, you know, you can even do 12.5 every other day. What's the lowest strength you guys have? We have 25.
We've got 25 and we cut them in half. Yeah.
You cut it. Yeah.
Yeah. So 6.25 would be wonderful to have, or something even lower. So that, you know, again, that would be sort of equivalent to 10 milligrams perhaps of finerenone.
I think the starting dose in RALS was 12.5, if I remember correctly. Most of those patients in RALS with the stage 4 heart failure were all on 25. That was the most common dose.
Yeah, but I wonder, you know, to AC's point, I suspect what is going to happen is mostly people will use finerenone. You know, that the machine of Bayer is so strong. They have pushed out 15 papers on fine arts already. It's amazing, right? Again, I'm not blaming them. I think they are really good at bombarding, right? Analysis by this way, analysis by that way, analysis by, you know, cutting things this way and that way, and fine arts, and, you know, by obesity, by diabetes. It just is so much data that comes to you, right? Compared to investigator-initiated trial where, you know, it takes me a year or two to get stuff written up and submit it to one journal, then another journal. These guys have a machine and people, and they just churn out papers after papers, which, you know, blankets the airwaves, and people just use it, right? Again, it's not bad. I'm not saying, you know, I know Nayan's smiling and laughing at me, but it's not bad. I think it will increase MRA usage overall, which is not a bad outcome. And I wonder how, you know, when ASIs and all those other data come out, what's going to happen. It's going to be a very interesting space. But overall, I think aldo inhibition will go up, which is, or aldo synthesis will go down. It's all the same thing, right? We'll knock aldo out, which is a good thing.
Would you rather spend your time doing a prior auth to get finerenone or just prescribe spironolactone? Like, when they get turned down for finerenone, right?
Yeah, I was just going to say, and what I do with my men, I often don't even start the spironolactone. I just go straight to a eplerenone because they'll read the side effect of gynecomastia and they'll be terrified. And a eplerenone is still often very expensive at a lot of pharmacies, even though it is generic, but it is on costplusdrugs.com and it's more affordable there. So I think that that's something too that we should not be afraid to use, even though the data aren't quite as strong as they are for spironolactone, that a lot of my male patients are very grateful when
you
I
think
just...
the data sucks for spironolactone, you should see it for eplerenone. You're a hell of a salesperson.
They didn't have Bayer behind them.
Right.
But that was a name brand drug just
until a few years ago.
Yeah, a few years.
Yeah, but I think the pharmaceutical trial area is so much more mature now, right? The drugs that have fallen by the wayside are more likely to be successful now, which is kind of like atrasentan failed a few years ago and now it's making a comeback. Because we have got the right outcomes, we have got the right people doing the trials. So it's a positive step that has happened in the recent years. And unfortunately, there's no one to do the spironolactone trial unless, you know, Jordi and I come together to do something.
Okay, let's get our tubular secretions. Tubular secretions is where we talk about something that we're filling our time with, usually not medicine. But it could be medicine if that's what you really want to talk about. What do you got, Swap?
So I'm watching this series on Apple TV called Disclaimer. It's a small, 6-part series, I think. It's directed by Alfonso Cuarón, who's a very, you know, big director. He directed one of the Harry Potter movies and Gravity and many other movies. It stars Cate Blanchett and Kevin Kline. I love Kevin Kline ever since I saw him in Fish Called Wanda. And he plays a very mischievous, it's a very dark, it's rated R or mature or something for TV audiences. But it's really good. Disclaimer.
Really good. Okay. It's called Disclaimer on Apple TV. Okay. AC, what do you got?
All right. So one of the things that I really struggle with is learning languages, despite having lived in Houston, where the majority of the people speak Spanish. And it's something that my husband and I are both working at. And, you know, using Duolingo, as most people do. And have you guys used this app where, at all hours of the day, it's just reminding you to use it constantly? Have you guys done this?
That sounds terrible, actually.
Yeah, no, it is. But they put out the best ad campaign I think I've ever seen, where they have created the mascot for Duolingo, a plushie. And they have made the best ad campaign where people hide it around the house as like a reminder to other people in the house to use their Duolingo and not break their streak. It's horrifying. And so I have ordered one off of Amazon. I'm about to start hiding this around the house to cause terror in the heart of my husband. So he doesn't know about this, but by the time this podcast comes out, he will be horrified by it. But we will probably know more Spanish for it.
Your tubular secretion is a Duolingo plushie.
Yes, it is. It is. It is. It is. But ask me next time. Maybe I'll know some more Spanish.
Okay. Okay. Nayan, what do you got?
So I'm reading this book right now by Daniel Trissoni called The Puzzle Box. It's okay. It's not bad. And essentially, it's about the protagonist, Mike Brink, who gets in this accident. It's a sequel to the first book in this series called The Puzzle Master. And it's about this guy who gets in an accident, develops savant syndrome, and becomes an expert at puzzle solving. And it's a little Dan Brown-esque where it blends historical references into, you know, modern times. And this book is he's in Japan solving a box called the Dragon Box, which has killed everybody else who has tried to solve this box. And so again, not amazing, but pretty good. And it's entertaining, if nothing else.
Okay. And so last year you were in Seattle and the University of Washington went to the national championship. Now you're in Oregon and the Ducks are the number one team in the country.
I'm the link to.
Which it is? Yeah, no. It's not, right? Okay. Excellent. Very cool. Go Ducks. Jordy, what do you got?
So I'm constantly looking for something that's like golden age sci-fi that does not treat women like one-dimensional objects. And it's very hard to find that because in golden age sci-fi, notoriously, it's either like super progressive in sort of like unusual ways, or like the women are one-dimensional objects. And so I had just read Childhood's End hoping for something a little bit better, and it was so not that. It was the movie that it was the book that Independence Day was somewhat based off of, but it gets way darker and no, not great. So I needed a palate cleanser, and I finally got around to reading Project Hail Mary by Andy Weir, and that is the opposite. So if you want a non-one-dimensional female, go for that. It's apparently going to be a movie, so if anyone doesn't like reading books, I think it's got some incredibly big-name casts coming in 2026. But if you like reading the book before the movie comes out, it is fabulous, and it is so nerdy, and it's the main character is a middle school science teacher, and his names for different biological substances are fabulous, and I just strongly recommend it if you're like super nerdy and want some hard sci-fi.
Okay, that's a great... I think it's not the first time it's been recommended as on Freely Filtered. It's been a favorite here. Excellent.
Can you give us a tubular secretion?
Yeah, sure.
But you can sure talk about your podcast.
Yeah, talk about your podcast.
Well, I've started a podcast with Sheikh Wadani called Kidney Compass. And what we're doing is really trying to offer a deep dive into some of the methodological aspects of kidney trials, some of the newer endpoints, GFR slope, and how we can better understand and interpret kidney trials going forward. So we have a range of guests. We've got some people coming on from the Parasol Consortium, which is looking on how to accelerate drug development in FSGS soon. So keep an eye out for that. And then outside of nephrology, I have a real thing for singer-songwriters, and I just saw Maggie Rogers, one of my favorite singer-songwriters, finish her tour in the US recently, and it's great to see her career progress, and I'm a huge fan, so check her out.
Hey, thanks for joining us, Brendan.
I'm listening to a book. So there was the guy's name is Ray Kurzweil, and he wrote
Singularity is Near.
The Singularity is Near, but his most recent one is it Singularity is Near? Yeah, I think it is.
That's an old one. That's an old book.
Okay, well, let's find out. Okay, give me a second.
But that's the one I know. Yeah.
Yeah. I read The Age of Spiritual Machines like in the 90s, and it's actually The Singularity is Nearer. It's his most recent.
Okay.
It came out this year, and it's about artificial intelligence. And he talks a lot about how it actually works. He goes into, you know, what's the programming? What is the transformer model? And he talked a lot about the philosophy of what it's going to mean to have computers that are as smart or smarter than us. And it is a pretty fun read. I would recommend it. I'm having a good time reading it. Ray Kurzweil, The Singularity is Nearer. Okay.
Do you want to say something about Blue Sky? Or
yeah,
Swaf, what is this Blue Sky? Everybody seems to be into it.
Yeah, so Blue Sky is this new, the new kid on the block. It's a social media platform, sort of like Twitter. A few months ago, when we were not happy with how Twitter was going with the new ownership, we explored different options, and Mastodon was what we looked at. And Mastodon is nice. It's like no one owns it, but it's very clunky. Blue Sky is not clunky. It feels way much like Twitter. It has got hashtags. It has got DMs, though not group DMs. It has got GIFs, possible to, you know, block someone without them seeing your tweets, which is what happens with Twitter now. And it seems like a very fun environment. It was invite only last year, so it did not take off. But in February of 2024, it became open for everyone. And especially in the last week, the subscriptions have really, the signups have taken off. Like earlier today, I saw something like 800 people were signing per minute. They have crossed 16 million, which again, in the big scheme of things, 16 million is nothing compared to Twitter, which is several hundred million. But I think it's scaling up very nicely. So a lot of us are, I think all of us are on Blue Sky. And Jordi posted about this on Blue Sky, about our podcast on Blue Sky. And check out the blog on FJC, where we tell you how to access Blue Sky. There are these cool things called starter packs, which are very useful because, you know, you can go on the starter pack and follow everyone. So we have a starter pack only allows 150 people. So we have created like the third starter pack right now. But you can find all your tribe, right? You can find all of us rather than, you know, search for Kidney Boy and search for Captain Chloride and search for MedPete's Kidney and search for Jordi BC. You can just go to the starter pack, follow all, and you'll be able to follow, you know, the whole old Nef Twitter community. This seems to be the real deal. I suspect this will be the Twitter.
Yeah.
Or I hope it will be the Twitter.
Yeah, there's some, even though it feels a lot like Twitter, there's one of the things that's really interesting is we were kind of slaves to the algorithm on Twitter. Like whatever the Twitter company decided was going to be the way that the algorithm would work and your feed would change. And I know my feed has been all politics and all Ukrainian war for the last few months. Like medicine seems to have completely fallen off my radar screen. And people have workarounds by using lists or what have you. But on Blue Sky, it comes with two standard feeds, but then you can select from hundreds of other feed types. And it's really interesting. So the algorithm is modifiable, and a lot of people have developed different types of feeds. You know, some of them are purely chronologic and others have different types of algorithms that promote different types of viewpoints. One of them I love is it's
quiet posters.
It's the quiet feed. Yeah. And it's just the quiet ones. And it just feeds you people that rarely post, which I love to get those people promoted to the top. It's kind of cool.
Yeah. And then there's a Med Sky and a Nephro Sky feed. So if you don't like the politics, which maybe, you know, you do follow people who talk about politics. If you go to the Nephro Sky feed, it's almost purely nephrology. So there are many, many feeds.
It's Nephro Sky feed. I have not seen that. Cool.
It's Neph Sky. If you just hit the hashtag in the upper right-hand corner, it shows you the feeds, and then you can just click on it, and you can add it to your home feeds, and it'll just show up for you, like next to your like Discover and your home screen. It's just a button that you'll be able to click all the time. It's really nice and user-friendly and pretty simple. I think the only downside from my observation so far, compared to what I'd liked about Twitter, I refuse to call it X, was that the bookmarking. You had searchable bookmarks, which were really nice, but I've just created a folder in my personal bookmarks, and I've just been adding stuff to my personal bookmarks and on like my browser, and I feel like that's fine. Like we just can get over that. And the group chat are the two things lacking. I don't really notice anything else.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have polls and we don't have post scheduling,
yeah.
But it'll come, right? Like they didn't even have DMs, they didn't have hashtags a year ago. So I suspect it's coming. It's a small team. And right now, like today, it was freezing all the time because of the number of signups were so huge. They were struggling to handle it. So I hope all these features are coming. There are workarounds, like for bookmarks, there is a pushpin emoji. So if you reply to a post with that pushpin, it goes into there's a feed with the pushpin. Which are your bookmarks. So, you know, it goes there, but then it's public, right? So I'll know all the posts that you have bookmarked, Jordi. It's not personal. So these workarounds are not perfect, but I hope all these features will come in the next few months. When Twitter started, it did not have DMs. It did not have group DMs. They did not have polls. They did not have GIFs, right? So all these things came later on. Blue Sky is pretty rich already. So I hope the other features come. And I hope it remains open and we don't fall slaves to the algorithm. I'm hoping. that happens.
Yeah, Dave Weiner, who's a savant and a commentator on these types of things, he's skeptical about Blue Sky. He's worried that since it hasn't been bought by a billionaire yet, it still could be. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. Hey, thanks everybody. This has been great.
Why are there so few songs about kidneys? It's like the world doesn't care. There are so many songs about hearts, but there's nothing special there. They're just amazing and so fascinating. Everyone knows that it's true. This song's about 'em. We can't live without 'em. The kidneys in me and in you. Trust them, they'll give you homeostasis. It's not a joke to me. When you are thirsty and drink too much water, the kidneys dilute your pee. When things, they go wrong, your kidneys, they stay strong, ready to take the lead. You don't have to worry, your kidneys know just what you need. Millions of nephrons working together beautifully, constantly. Glomeruli and tubules, choose one. We love them both equally. Infatuation with glomerular filtration, I just might shed a tear. Flows in, prescribing, and not dialyzing. Isn't that why we're